May the words of my mouth and the meditation of each heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. One of the last stops on our 10-day tour in Israel and Palestine this past May was at the Holocaust Memorial. It's called Yad Vashem. Yad Vashem contains the atrocities of the Holocaust, a story that unfolds chapter by chapter, room to room, horror upon horror. As the voice in our headphones intoned an explanation of each new display, my heart and feet grew heavier. Some rooms we could barely squeeze into. Droves of new Israeli troops, these are 18 and 19-year-olds, with military-grade weapons slung over their backs, just packed into this museum. More than once, I had to sidestep a teenager. Just like that, the gun right there in plain sight, casually like you'd wear a backpack or a purse. We'd seen that many times throughout our trip, but I can tell you it's not something you ever get used to. The irony of them being there in the Holocaust Museum with their weapons, that was an irony not lost on me. Yad Vashem is the World Holocaust Remembrance Center. In the United States, we have the Holocaust Memorial Museum. Remembrance, memorial. We go to these places that we know will haunt our souls because we also know, no matter how difficult it is, that we must remember. We must remember so that we don't forget. There's no doubt that you've heard the phrase credited to the Spanish philosopher George Santayana. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Today we return to King David's story in 2 Samuel. David, to this point, has been a pretty savvy leader. Although he marks the beginning of a new regime in Jerusalem, and that regime marks a pretty radical departure from the way that things have always been done in Israel, he has played his hand well. David, it seems, can try anything and succeed. It's like it's his destiny. But in today's chapter of David's story, from 2 Samuel chapter 6, David forgets. Okay, so a little bit of a backstory on the Ark. We'll just reach into the recesses of Israel's history for just a moment. Per God's instructions to Moses, an Israelite artisan crafts the Ark. And per God's instructions, Moses places the two tablets with the Ten Commandments on them. Those go into the Ark. And the Ark, then filled with those tablets and Aaron's rod and some manna, travel with the Israelites throughout the desert, from Sinai into the Promised Land. Led by the Ark, the Israelites make it all the way to that land of milk and honey. So just to help you get the picture, the Ark of the Covenant is this huge wooden box. It's adorned with two cherubim, which is the fancy church word for angels. They're so big and their wings are so magnificent that they're each on a different end of the box and their wings meet in the middle. It was an imposing enough of a thing that you just knew when you saw it that you weren't to mess around with it. Think like Raiders of the Lost Ark. I imagine the Israelites processing the Ark around feels a little bit like a baseball player feels when they're going out to their at-bat and like their jam is playing. Like the Israelites felt invincible when they had the Ark. Fast forward several chapters in Israel's history. The Ark goes virtually unmentioned until the time of Samuel. Samuel, when he was a child and he received his call from God, he was where the Ark of God was. It makes its reappearance. But then in the fourth chapter of 1 Samuel, the unthinkable happens. The Israelites go up against the Philistines, and while the Israelites have the Ark, the Philistines have chariots, and the Israelites don't really stand a chance. The Philistines capture the Ark. The only problem there is the Ark starts to make the Philistines around it sick. People are dying. The Philistines want nothing to do with it, and so they try to return it to the Israelites and get their money back. Just kidding. They don't even ask for their money back. They give the Israelites a guilt offering. They just want that thing out of their hands. So now Israel has the ark back, but people aren't happy with it. This is the moment, you might recall from a few weeks ago, when all the Israelites gang up on Samuel and they say, "We want to be like the other nations, give us a king." And so amid all of that change, the ark is forgotten. It just starts to gather dust. It stays in a town with a very biblical name for a very long time, and no one thinks a whole lot about it. That's where we pick up in today's reading. If you've been dozing off during this little ark history lesson, tune back in for this. The ark of God's presence was a big deal to the Israelites. They know that God is with them when the ark is with them, and they know now that bad things happen to them when the ark isn't with them. In short, the ark has a history. It has significance to the people of Israel. But David forgets that. He forgets that. He forgets how the ark is supposed to be carried. He orders that a new cart be made for the ark. That's not how the ark is carried. Priests with poles carry the ark. With the ark on their backs, the priests could feel the weight of God's presence with them. There are two young men who are assigned to drive this cart, ill-conceived as it was, and at one point in the procession, one of the oxen starts to lose his footing, and so Uzzah grabs the ark just for a second. It's just a gut reaction. David forgot to mention, you don't touch the ark. Uzzah dies. And to be fair, it's not just David who forgets. The Israelites do their own forgetting too. They forget to offer a sacrifice. They're so busy singing and dancing and making a big racket. I can't imagine who would do that. David and the Israelites want all the benefits of the ark, but they don't really want to invest in the work of it, the time, the money that this institution of the ark requires. And to David's credit, he does realize pretty quickly that his forgetting actually cost someone his life. And David freaks out. He gets scared. He decides that he's just going to pull that ark over and park it at someone else's house for 3 months. It's easy, isn't it? It's so easy to fall into that trap that David does, to forget that the common good outweighs our own personal good. It's so easy to forget that everything that we have, our blessings, didn't magically appear. People came before us and they sacrificed to create the things that we can too easily take for granted. I mean, I'm talking big things, our institutions, our civic infrastructure, our economy. They were built for us, not to ravenously consume, but to shepherd, to steward, to improve, and then to pass on to our children so that our children can pass that on to their children. We're a link in the chain, not the whole. So maybe in some ways we too have forgotten how to care for the ark, for the common good. We tend to want to make our own decisions, even decisions that impact all of us, based on our own personal preferences. But there's more to this story. After David gets over his anger and fear, he remembers that the good fortune experienced by the people at his ark parking station for those 3 months, well, they ended up having a lot of good fortune. He wants the whole of Israel, the whole of God's people, to know that goodness, to know that blessing. And so David does what he can to recover the ark, but this time he decides to do it a little bit differently. He digs around and he finds an ephod. It's a fancy word for a sleeveless garment that a priest would wear. That served as a sign that he was really taking the ark seriously this time. He gave up the cart. After those who carried the ark had taken 6 steps, they stopped, and David offered a sacrifice to God. Not just one sacrifice, but 2, an ox and a fatling. Once David remembers and recommits himself to the greater good, to something bigger than himself, to God's way, to God's intention, that's when David dances. Beloved, we live in a world that is hungry for connection to something bigger, something greater, something beyond, something more important than ourselves. The God of the universe created us, after all. It's what we are made for. So what's something that's bigger than you? What are you living for that's so much bigger, so much greater, so much more important than you are? Decide what that is and hold on to it. Remember it. And then live like that bigger, greater thing. Live like it's something that you have an important part to play in. There's a room in the Yad Vasham dedicated to those who are called righteous among the nations. The righteous are non-Jews who took great risks to serve or to save Jews during the Holocaust, serve them too. These rescues took place in all sorts of forms, and the righteous came from all different nations, all different religious traditions, all different walks of life. What they had in common was they protected their Jewish neighbors at a time when hostility and indifference prevailed. And the exhibit notes that most of these rescuers started off as bystanders when they were confronted with the deportation or the killing of Jews. Some stood by in the early stages of the persecution when the rights of Jews were restricted and their property was being confiscated. But there came a point. There came a point, or maybe it was a line, when they just decided that they were going to act. There was this boundary that they were just not willing to cross. And so they had to do something about it. They didn't fall into a pattern of acquiescing to the escalating measures against the Jews. The way Yad Vasham explains it, in a world of total moral collapse, there was a small minority who mustered extraordinary courage to uphold human values. Contrary to the general trend, these rescuers regarded Jews as fellow human beings who came within the bounds of their universe of obligation. In other words, the righteous remembered, even if not right away, that they were living for something bigger, something greater, something more important than themselves.